This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Medical School. Our program today will bring you articles from Science Daily, The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Smithsonian, New Scientist, to name a few. This is Tricia Droney. And today I'll start with an article from the New York Times written by Tammy LaGorse on March 6, 2026, entitled, From Endangered Plants Come Whiffs of Inspiration. In the 1970s, the pop ballad Time in a Bottle sounded like a wistful love song. In 2026, it has become an olfactory mission statement. Conservationists, perfumers, and biotech engineers are separately making moves to bottle time in the form of fragrance. Their efforts respond to an uncomfortable truth. Unless we capture scents made by certain prized plants now, our beleaguered environment and consumption could put an end to them. The vanilla, lavender, and sandalwood industries, to name a few, are facing significant threats due to climate change and other negative influences such as habit destruction, said Peggy Fielder, a leader of the Red List Project, a nonprofit focused on global plant conservation. All are cultivated species of great importance to the fragrance industry. Dr. Fielder and her Red List Project co-leader, Vanessa Handley, who are both biologists, have come up with a novel way of calling attention to the plight of endangered plants. Since 2018, they've been appealing to the fragrance industry for support. We started cold calling these big companies whose work is contingent on inspiration from the natural world, Dr. Handley said. The carrot they dangled was the offer of scents from threatened plants that could give rise to new fragrance ingredients. In 2021, the French prestige fragrance house Maine, M-A-N-E, which works with Gucci, signed on as a partner. Maine has since developed three scents based on plants suggested by the Red List Project. According to Dr. Fiedler, the company's perfumers describe the scent synthesized from a magnolia found in Ecuador as fresh, green, and creamy, like the skin of a peach. The one that came from the wood of a Caribbean juniper was surprisingly floral with woody, buttery undertones like rosewood. And the one derived from a syed plant from Guam had a tutti-frutti character, reminiscent of mango or peach jam. In return, the nonprofit received donations and a percentage of sales from Maine to devote to conservation work. Other fragrance companies and perfumers have followed suit and become donors. In 2022, Dr. Fiedler started working with the heritage American perfumer Blocky to help revive its vintage Brazilian lily scent, which hasn't been bottled since the early 1900s. The original formulation has been lost to time. No one at Blocky has smelled the lily from which the perfume was derived, said Tammy Kramer, the company's co-owner. In Brazil, the flower is classified as endangered, preventing it from being harvested. Some perfumers use headspace capture, a procedure that allows scents to be extracted from plants in the wild without harming them. Blocky did not. But an understanding gained from the Red List Project of the lily's rainforest habitat and a study of its close floral relatives enabled Blocky to reimagine its fragrance. We went for something green and fresh and misty, Ms. Kramer said. You can almost smell dewdrops on green leaves. Future Society is another company developing scents that are meant to remind consumers of the fragility of plant life. Jasmina Aganovic, who studied chemical and bioengineering as an undergraduate, founded the company in 2023 taking advantage of once prohibitively expensive DNA sequencing technology to create a collection inspired by extinct flowers. She and Christina Agapakis, a biologist, worked with preserved extinct plants at the Gray Herbarium at Harvard University to create the collection Scent Surrection. Fragrance companies, including the Swiss from Givaudan, helped formulate the perfumes. The suite includes a scent called Grassland Opera that was meant to evoke a flowering plant lost partially as a result of 19th century buffalo migration near the Ohio River. Solar Canopy, a sweet and fruity fragrance in the collection, could be what the Hawaiian hibiscus smelled like before it succumbed to deforestation. Ms. Aganovic and Ms. Agapakis were careful about not overselling future society's ability to resurrect lost scents. A flower never smells the same way, Ms. Agapakis said. The odor of a rose, for example, changes with the time of day and where it is in its life cycle. Different roses grown in different parts of the world in different environments are going to smell differently, she added. Social media has been quick to pounce on the company's unavoidable use of creative license. Somebody said, "What a great way to scam people, because there's no way people can go back in time and confirm what a flower smelled like," Ms. Aganovic said. "But I never thought this was an exercise in precision." Ms. Agapakis added, "The art of it is we can get these traces from the DNA. There are things our nose can notice, but the plant itself is sort of a ghost." Referring to Future Society's work, Dr. Fiedler said she found value in olfactory ghost stories for plants as well as perfumers. "It may be sort of fun and sexy to think about wearing an extinct scent," she noted. "So more power to them for telling the story, for raising awareness that plants go extinct." 6 months ago, the biotech company Debut in San Diego started using machines that can recode plant cells to replicate scents. Some of those scents are natural and rare. Others are never-before-sniffed novelties. The company, which also uses AI, is selling its lab-grown smells to fragrance makers for use in perfumes. Joshua Britton, Debut's founder, said that few people would recognize that the company's vetiver, a kind of grass, and orris, the root of the iris flower, have been produced artificially, apart from the bean counter's tallying expenses. Orris can go for about $100,000 a kilogram, Dr. Britton said. The molecules Debut uses to mimic it, by contrast, are very cheap. Biotechnology enables the whittling of production time, too. The traditional ways of synthesizing orris for perfume takes 5 years, he said. We can ferment it like a wine in 5 days. The potential benefits reach past bottom lines into the habitats where at-risk plants are growing wild. It takes 250,000 petals to create 5 milliliters of rose oil, Dr. Britton said. Nature is no longer producing these ingredients the way it used to. In the interest of sparing plants, we can do better. Next up, an article written May 26, 2025 by Ivan Penn entitled, "Electric Vehicles Died a Century Ago. Could that happen again?" More than a century before Tesla rolled out its first cars, the Baker Electric Coupe and the Ryker Electric Roadster rumbled down American streets. Battery-powered cars were so popular that for a time, about a third of New York's taxis were electric. But those early electric vehicles began to lose ground to a new class of cars, like the Ford Model T, that were cheaper and could more easily be refueled by new oil-based fuels that were becoming available around the country. Bolstered by federal tax incentives in the 1920s, the oil industry boomed, and so did gasoline-powered cars. That history has largely been forgotten, and almost all of the early electric cars have disappeared so completely that most people alive today have never seen one, and many have no idea that they even existed. A few specimens are in museums and private collections, including a fully restored Baker Electric that Jay Leno keeps in his sprawling California garage. Mr. Leno's ancient electric car has a wooden frame and a 36-inch rubber wheels. It looks like a stagecoach, but it is propelled by electric motors and batteries, just like a current-day Tesla Model Y or Cadillac Lyriq. It elicited smiles and amazement from people on the streets of Burbank, California, when Mr. Leno drove it around town recently. The car may be a novelty, but it is newly relevant because the United States may be poised to repeat history. The Trump administration and Republicans in Congress are working to undercut the growth of electric vehicles, impose a new tax on them, and swing federal policy sharply in favor of oil and gasoline. Scholars who have studied the earlier age of electric vehicles see parallels in their demise in the early decades of the 1900s and the attacks they are facing now. In both eras, electric cars struggled to gain acceptance in the marketplace and were undermined by politics. A big knock against them was they had to be charged and ultimately were considered less convenient than vehicles with internal combustion engines. Electric cars are good if you have a towing company, President Trump said at a campaign rally in Iowa in October of 2023. At another appearance the next month, he said, "You can't get out of New Hampshire in an electric car." Charging and access to fuel were also concerns a century earlier. Americans in the 1920s wanted to explore the country, but many rural and suburban areas didn't have electricity. President Franklin D. Roosevelt made a big push to electrify the entire country in 1936. The last farms were connected to the grid in the early 1970s. That made it difficult to use electric cars in many places. Republican leaders say that electric vehicles do not deserve subsidies in the tax code and that their tax bill levels the playing field that Democrats had tilted in favor of one technology. 100 years ago, lawmakers also put their thumbs on the scale and came down on the side of oil. The oil industry has enjoyed numerous tax breaks. One was enacted in 1926 when Congress allowed oil companies to deduct their taxable income by 27.5% of their sales. The sponsor of the legislation later admitted that the incentive was excessive. "We grabbed 27.5% because we were not only hogs, but the odd figure made it appear as though it was scientifically arrived at," Senator Tom Connally, the Texas Democrat who sponsored the break, was quoted as saying in a biography of Lyndon Johnson, "Sam Johnson's boy, a close-up of the president from Texas." That tax break lasted for decades. It was eliminated for large oil producers and reduced for smaller companies in 1975. Perhaps unsurprisingly, crude oil became dominant. The Energy Department noted on a timeline on its website that electric cars are all but disappeared by 1935. The triumph of internal combustion made long-distance travel accessible to the masses and helped power the U.S. economy. It also led to deadly urban air pollution and has been a major cause of climate change. Now, the decades-long tug of war between combustion engine and electric cars is intensifying again. And electric cars may be in trouble, at least in the United States. Sales of electric cars are growing quickly in most of the rest of the world, increasing 35% in China in the first 4 months of the year and 25% in Europe, according to Rho Motion, a research firm. But in the United States, sales were up a modest 11% in the first 3 months of 2025, according to the Kelley Blue Book. Republican leaders are pushing legislation that would eliminate many Biden administrative programs intended to promote electric vehicle sales, including $7,500 federal tax credit. They also want to impose a new annual $250 fee on electric vehicle owners to finance highway construction and maintenance. While the Republican changes probably won't kill electric vehicles, they could set the industry back years. EV momentum in the U.S. has slowed, with policy uncertainty mounting, analysts at Bernstein said in a note this month. A reminder to our readers, this article was written in May of 2025, so a little under a year ago. But electric cars have not just been hampered by politics, they also had to overcome gender stereotypes. Their benefits, like quiet, smooth operation, were considered by some men to be too feminine. And in the late 1800s and early 1900s, many models, like the Baker Electric, were explicitly marketed only to women. Advertisements for the early electrics hang on the walls of Mr. Leno's Burbank garage. Quote, "Make this the happiest Christmas. Give your wife an electric," proclaims one. On another, a young woman pleads, "Daddy, get me a Baker." Men, by contrast, have long been pitched on the masculine virtues of gasoline vehicles that roar and thunder. In the fall of 2022, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, who is closely allied with Mr. Trump, that is no longer true, but certainly was when this was written, pushed the notion that gasoline cars are more macho at a rally. There's nothing more American than the roar of a V8 engine under the hood of a Ford Mustang or Chevy Camaro, an incredible feel of all that horsepower. But Democrats, she said, want to emasculate the way we drive. Elon Musk, Tesla's chief executive, who has been working with the Trump administration, has tried to broaden the appeal of electric vehicles. His company's newest model is the Cybertruck, a massive pickup truck with lots of sharp angles. Musk has done everything he could to try to make Tesla a manly vehicle, said Virginia Scharf, an emeritus distinguished professor of history at the University of New Mexico and author of numerous books, including Taking the Wheel, Women and the Coming of the Motor Age. But Ms. Scharf added, Mr. Musk may have gone too far. His alignment with Mr. Trump's conservative politics has alienated some of the most reliable buyers of electric cars, liberals and environmentalists who hope to move the world away from fossil fuels. Here's like the gender flip. Tesla is so associated with a kind of toxic masculinity now, as opposed to the electric car being associated with femininity in the early part of the 20th century, Ms. Scharf said. Mr. Leno, the former Tonight Show host, who now has an online show focused on cars, Jay Leno's Garage, has a restored 1909 Baker Electric in his collection. It has a top speed of 25 miles per hour and can travel 80 miles on a full charge. With a high-top cab decorated in Victorian flair, it has two fabric cushioned bench seats facing each other and roller shades on the windows. The car was meant to accommodate fanciful women's hats, which at the turn of the century were often big and bold. As an added touch, the car's designers mounted a makeup case inside the car. "What do men like?" Mr. Leno said. "Something that rolls, explodes, and makes noise. That's why men like the gasoline car, because it frightened children, you know, that type of thing." Mr. Leno said he loves the Baker, which he drives around Burbank at least once a year to see holiday lights and decorations with his wife. He said such vehicles had many merits and convenience among them. They are low maintenance, they're fast, and you can fuel them at home, particularly at night when electricity is generally much more affordable than during the day. The concept of home charging isn't new. Car chargers also made their debut a century ago, only bulkier and a bit more frightful. "It looked like a machine out of Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory," said Leslie Kendall, chief historian at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. Mr. Kendall said electric cars could have stuck around and even done well, but they were hampered by the lack of electricity in many communities, long charging times, and their higher costs relative to gasoline vehicles. A Model T in 1908 cost about $650, compared with $1,750 for an electric roadster. "You could carry extra gas with you," he said. "You couldn't carry extra electricity." Richard Riker, grandson of an electric car pioneer, Andrew Riker, said his grandfather had identified one of the biggest stumbling blocks to the cars he designed and sold, one that lingers to this day. "They didn't have charging stations out on the street corners like my grandfather said they need to," Mr. Riker said. During the Biden administration, Congress sought to address that shortcoming by allocating $7.5 billion for the construction of public chargers. Mr. Trump halted that program. One of Andrew Ryker's cars from the mid-1890s, a topless two-seater cab that still sputters along at about 15 miles an hour, is on display at the Peterson Museum along with other electric vehicles, both from history and those under development. Despite policy and other challenges, Mr. Ryker said he was still optimistic about electric vehicles. He expects that in the coming decades, technical advances will give such vehicles a big edge over gasoline vehicles. If you can charge a car in 5 minutes and go 500 miles, he said, the gasoline engine is history. Our next article was written by Paula Spann and is entitled Health Risks from Cannabis May Grow as Users Age. Dr. Benjamin Hahn, a geriatrician and addiction medicine specialist at the University of California, San Diego, tells his students a cautionary tale about a 76-year-old patient who, like many older people, struggled with insomnia. She had problems falling asleep, and she'd wake up in the middle of the night, he said, so her daughter brought her some sleep gummies, edible cannabis candies. She tried a gummy after dinner and waited half an hour, Dr. Hahn said. Feeling no effects, she took another gummy, then one more, a total of four over several hours. Dr. Hahn advises patients who are trying cannabis to start low, go slow, beginning with products that contain just 1 or 2.5 milligrams of THC, the psychoactive ingredient that many cannabis products contain. Each of the four gummies this patient took, however, contained 10 milligrams. The woman started feeling intense anxiety and experiencing heart palpitations. A young person might have shrugged off such symptoms, but this patient had hypertension and the heart arrhythmia called AFib. Frightened, she went to an emergency room. Lab tests and a cardiac workup determined that the woman wasn't having a heart attack, and the staff sent her home. Her only lingering symptom was embarrassment, Dr. Hahn said. But what if she'd grown dizzy or lightheaded and was hurt in a fall? He said he has had patients injured in falls or while driving after using cannabis. What if the cannabis had interacted with the prescription drugs she took? As a geriatrician, it gives me pause, Dr. Hahn said. Our brains are more sensitive to psychoactive substances as we age. 39 states and the District of Columbia now allow cannabis use for medical reasons. And in 24 of those states, as well as Washington, recreational use is also legal. As older adults use climbs, the benefits are still unclear, Dr. Hahn said. But we're seeing more evidence of potential harms. A wave of recent research points to reasons for concern for older users, with cannabis-related emergency room visits and hospitalizations rising, and a Canadian study finding an association between such acute care and subsequent dementia. Older people are more apt than younger ones to try cannabis for therapeutic reasons, to relieve chronic pain, insomnia, or mental health issues. But evidence of its effectiveness in addressing those conditions remains thin, experts said. In an analysis of national survey data published a year ago in the medical journal JAMA, Dr. Hahn and his colleagues reported that current cannabis use, defined as use within the previous 30 days, had jumped among adults over age 65 to 7% of respondents in 2023 from 4.8% in 2021. Back in 2005, he pointed out, fewer than 1% of older adults reported using cannabis in the previous year. What's driving the increase? Experts cite the steady march of state legalization. Use by older people is highest in those states, while surveys show that the perceived risk of cannabis use has declined. One national survey found that a growing proportion of American adults, 44% in 2021, erroneously thought it's safer to smoke cannabis daily than cigarettes. The authors of the study in JAMA Network Open noted that these views do not reflect the existing science on cannabis and tobacco smoke. The cannabis industry also markets its products to older adults. The Trulieve chain gives a 10% discount, both in stores and online, to so-called wisdom customers over 55. Rise Dispensaries ran a year-long quote, cannabis education and empowerment program for two senior centers in Paterson, New Jersey, including field trips to its dispensary. The industry has many satisfied older customers. Liz Logan, 67, a freelance writer in Bronxville, New York, has grappled with sleep problems and anxiety for years, but the conditions grew particularly debilitating 2 years ago as her husband was dying of Parkinson's disease. I'd frequently be awake until 5 or 6 in the morning, she said. It really makes you crazy. Looking online for edible cannabis products, Miss Logan found that gummies containing cannabidiol, known as CBD, alone didn't help, but those with 10 milligrams of THC did the trick without noticeable side effects. I don't worry about sleep anymore, she said. I've solved a lifelong problem. But studies in the United States and Canada, which legalized non-medical cannabis nationally in 2018, show climbing rates of older people seeking medical treatment for cannabis-related issues, both in outpatient settings and in hospitals. In California, for instance, cannabis-related emergency room visits by those over 65 rose to about 395 per 100,000 visits in 2019 from 21 in 2005. In Ontario, acute care, meaning emergency visits or hospital admissions resulting from cannabis use, increased fivefold in middle-aged adults between 2008 and 2021, and more than 26-fold among those over 65. It's not reflective of everyone who's using cannabis, cautioned Dr. Daniel Myron, an investigator at the Breyer Health Research Institute in Ottawa and lead author of the Ontario study. It's capturing people with more severe patterns. But since other studies have shown increased cardiac risk among some cannabis users with heart disease or diabetes, there's a number of warning signals, he said. For example, a disturbing proportion of older veterans who currently use cannabis screen positive for cannabis use disorder, a recent JAMA Open study found. As with other substance abuse disorders, such patients can tolerate high amounts, said the lead author, Viva Pavosid, a cannabis researcher at the Northern California Institute for Research and Education. They continue using even if it interferes with their social or work or family obligations, and many experience withdrawal if they stop. Among 4,500 older veterans, average age 73, seeking care at VA health facilities, researchers found that more than 10% had reported cannabis use within the past 30 days. Of those, 36% fit the criteria for mild, moderate, or severe cannabis use disorder, and established in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. VA patients differ from the general population, Dr. Pravasud noted. They are much more likely to report substance abuse and have higher rates of chronic diseases and disabilities and mental health conditions like PTSD. It could lead to self-medication, she said. Current Department of Veterans Affairs policies don't require clinicians to ask patients about cannabis use. Dr. Pravasad thinks that they should. Moreover, there's increasing evidence of a potential effect on memory and cognition, said Dr. Myron, citing his team's study of Ontario patients with cannabis-related conditions going to emergency departments or being admitted to hospitals. It showed that compared to others of the same age and sex who were seeking care for other reasons, these patients, ages 45 to 105, had 1.5 times the risk of a dementia diagnosis within 5 years and 3.9 times the risk for the general population. Even after adjusting for chronic health conditions and socio-demographic factors, those seeking acute care resulting from cannabis use had a 23% higher dementia risk than patients with non-cannabis-related ailments and a 72% higher risk than the general population. None of these studies were randomized clinical trials, the researchers pointed out. They were observational and could not ascertain causality. Some cannabis research doesn't specify whether users are smoking, vaping, ingesting, or rubbing topical cannabis on aching joints. Other studies lack relevant demographic information. It's very frustrating that we're not able to provide more individual guidance on safer modes of consumption and on amounts of use that seem lower risk, Dr. Myron said. It just highlights that the rapid expansion of regular cannabis use in North America is outpacing our knowledge. Still, given the health vulnerabilities of older people and the far greater potency of current cannabis products compared to the weed of their youth, he and other researchers urge caution. If you view cannabis as a medicine, you should be open to the idea that there are groups who probably shouldn't use it and that there are potential adverse effects from it, he said, because that is true of all medicines. Next up from Science Daily is a more practical article, scientifically based, entitled, How to Break Free from Your Phone. There's that nagging voice again. Put the phone away. No, really, this time. But we don't. 84% of Americans say that they are online either several times a day or almost constantly. On your deathbed, what kind of life do you want to look back on? Said Catherine Price, author of How to Break Up with Your Phone, when we asked her how to stop the constant scrolling. One in which you spent your time with people you love and on things that brought you meaning and joy, or one that you spent staring down at your phone. So, how do we cut back? We were tired of the same old advice that tells us to use grayscale screens and app timers, so we went in search of new ideas. Screen time experts who advocate a healthier relationship with the technology shared tricks that aren't widely known, but really work. For instance, Frida India, author of the Substack Girls, she says, choose a goal and set a deadline. Book a driving test before you're ready. Sign up for a marathon before you started training. Invite friends to dinner before you know how to cook. With a deadline looming, your spare time fills with preparation and practice. You can't afford to scroll. I realized this recently after months of cramming to meet a ridiculous deadline. My screen time has never been lower. Now I look back with horror at how many skills I could have learned over the years and the hours wasted. Nir Eyal, author of Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life, says always be charging. Set up a central charging altar and leave your phone there when you get home. When your phone has a designated space, you're less likely to carry it like a digital pacifier. Claire Morell, author of The Tech Exit, A Practical Guide to Freeing Kids and Teens from Smartphones, says, swap out your smartphone. A year ago, I switched to the Wyze phone. It has no internet, email, social media, or addictive games or apps, but it does have an app store with a limited menu that includes a camera and other practical apps. Since I can't access the internet, there is no possibility of getting sucked into searching for or reading something online, or trying to place an Amazon order while I'm with my kids. Instead, I use the internet on my computer intentionally when I need to accomplish a task. Sherry Turkle, a professor at MIT, says, replace scrolling with me time. When I'm about to reach for TikTok, I give that time to myself instead. I read a poem or a chapter of a novel. I listen to new music or take a walk. I exercise. I stretch. And when I'm about to reach for Facebook or Instagram, instead, I call or text one of my friends and ask for a get-together. I make sure to say, I miss you. Paul Lenardi, author of the book Digital Exhaustion, says try batching. Rather than checking messages, social media, and email all day long, I set two or three specific times when I handle them all at once. I tend to batch three times a day, first thing in the morning, 15 minutes, right before lunch, 20 minutes, and in the afternoon around 4 for 40 minutes. Adam Alter, professor of marketing at NYU, says try a reverse streak. Apps like Forest, Streaks, and Offscreen can be used to gamify how long you don't use your phone. In the Forest app, You plant a tree and it grows based on how much time you spend away from your phone. Eventually, spending less time on your phone becomes a more ingrained habit. I like this streak-driven approach because it works in the short term by leveraging gamification while simultaneously building longer-term sustainable habits. Claire Morell says go phone-free on Saturday or Sunday. Our family sets aside one day each week to separate ourselves physically from our phones. If we get a call, we will hear it ring and can go look and see who it is in case there's an emergency. So our cell phones function more like a landline. If we do leave the house, one of us will bring our phone in case of emergency, but we keep it in a bag out of sight. Striving to go phone-free one day a week has helped us be mentally freer from work and the logistics of life to truly rest on the weekends and to be more present with our family. Catherine Price, the author of the Substack, How to Feel Alive, says, try something newish. Do the thing you know you should try but probably haven't. Get a standalone alarm clock and charge your phone out of your bedroom at night. Too daunting? Just try it for a week. I am continually amazed by how many people tell me this simple shift has changed their life. Jean Twenge says tuck in your phone at night. Get a sleeping bag for your phone as a reminder to put it outside of your bedroom. A clinical psychologist, Lisa Damore, says use your phone to disconnect. When I need to stay focused on what I'm doing, I set the phone's timer and keep it in sight. If my attention starts to wander, a quick glance at the countdown helps me power through. Cal Newport, professor of computer science at Georgetown, says, scroll like it's 2006. If your job requires some sort of social media monitoring or engagement, do it 2006 style on an old-fashioned laptop-based browser. Gabriella Nugent, founder of Abstinence, as in app, an organization that helps people reimagine life without social media and smartphones. Smartphone apps are only getting sexier and sexier. It'll be an endless battle to resist. I'd rather be in perpetual peace by using a dumb phone for my mobile number. I don't see this as a resignation, but a wise acknowledgement of when to walk away from something that is hurting me, whether that be a person or a phone. And finally, Anna Lemke, a psychiatrist and author of Dopamine Nation, says, do something difficult. We often turn to our phones to escape, reward ourselves, or relax. But what they actually do is create a constant state of reactivity and arousal. By putting the phone down and doing something that's a little bit painful, like crunching 10 sit-ups, immersing ourselves in an ice bath, or cleaning out a long-neglected closet, we get the satisfaction of having accomplished something in the real world. Next, from the New York Times Science section, an article written December 27, 2025, entitled How One Father Created an Organ Empire by Danielle Ivory Grace Ashford and Robert Gebeloff. The worst moment of Garrett Hill's life, he once said, came when he discovered he couldn't donate a kidney to his 6-10-year-old daughter. By the time the girl found a match a couple of months later, Mr. Hill, an entrepreneur, had drawn up plans to transform the world of living organ donation. His organization, the National Kidney Registry, started in 2007 with a simple idea. Donors who are incompatible with sick loved ones give their kidneys to a nationwide pool. The sick patients tap into that pool of strangers to find matches more quickly. Since its founding, NKR, again, National Kidney Registry, has enabled nearly 12,000 such swaps, called paired donations, far more than any other public or private program. The organization's focus on technology and efficiency has jolted a sluggish system, many health experts said. But at the same time, NKR has created a multi-million-dollar business with considerable power over the flow of thousands of organs, according to interviews with more than 100 people in transplant medicine and a review of business records. Many doctors told the Times the stakes of these life-saving exchanges were too high to be managed by a private company with little government oversight. As NKR has grown, it has charged hospitals steep fees for access to its registry of donors. Some of that cost is passed on to taxpayers through Medicare. The organization was a nonprofit for more than a decade, but during that period paid at least $39 million for technology and other services to a company owned by Mr. Hill, Charity Filing Show. In 2023, NKR's commercial operations were sold to a new for-profit company owned by Mr. Hill, making its finances much more opaque. About 40% of U.S. transplant centers work with the organization, and many have been pleased with improvements in the speed and quality of kidney matches. The median wait time for NKR patients is about 2 months, compared with several years on the national waiting list for kidneys from deceased donors. Nationwide, however, living kidney donations have stayed roughly flat since the organization's founding, according to the New York Times analysis of government transport plant data. Mr. Hill said that the number would have fallen if not for NKR, but many doctors said that the organization has simply found a way to profit off some transplants that likely would have happened anyway. "It's basically a money transfer," said Dr. Lloyd Ratner, a surgeon at Columbia University, who performed the second ever paired transplant in the country. He said the hospital had parted ways with NKR. Mr. Hill said his technology company had been compensated fairly for services it provided to the charity. And NKR's success, he said, might not have been possible without the extraordinary investment we have made or the incentives of a for-profit business. Many patients told the Times that they had a good experience with NKR and were matched quickly. A small number of hard-to-match patients, however, have waited months or years after their loved ones donated to a stranger. Some became too sick or died before they could get a kidney in return, doctors said. This year, the Times has reported on a range of problems in the organ transplant system, which largely relies on deceased donors. Decades ago, the United States made it illegal to sell organs and set up a national waiting list to try to ensure fairness. Today, about 90,000 people are waiting for deceased donor kidneys. A publicly available algorithm prioritizes them based on several factors, such as their age and how long they've been waiting. Kidneys from living donors are rarer and tend to last longer. But unlike deceased organ donation, living donation is generally arranged privately, with few federal rules about how to choose patients. For most of its matches, NKR relies on a computer program developed by Mr. Hill's company, which weighs patient compatibility and many other factors. But when donors don't match any recipient in the registry, the organization has broad discretion over which hospitals get those bonus kidneys. NKR gives the kidneys to hospitals that contribute the most to its network, an arrangement that some doctors said was unfair to patients outside of NKR hospitals. Mr. Hill said the policy, which was overseen by its medical board, is set up so that it drives behavior and incentivizes the transplant centers, which is for the greater good. Dozens of doctors and bioethicists told The Times that while NKR's goal of a nationwide system for living donations was laudable, they worried about a private company managing it. When someone is willing to donate a kidney to a stranger, that gift should be a national resource, said Dr. Adam Bingaman, who helped build a large hospital program for paired donations and now works at Emory University School of Medicine, an NKR subscriber. "It should not belong to a transplant center," he added. "It should not belong to a private organization." American surgeons began doing paired kidney donations in 2000. Early on, this meant a direct swap between two pairs of donors and recipients, but it swiftly progressed to longer chains. Initially, surgeries took place simultaneously to avoid scenarios in which one pair donated a kidney without promptly getting one back. Later, doctors realized that altruistic donors who give a kidney to a stranger for nothing in return could kick off a series of non-simultaneous donations. Mr. Hill aimed to make long chains connecting people across the country. Because his fledgling charity didn't have the resources to develop matching software, Mr. Hill said he turned to his technology business, Hill & Company. Initially, NKR ran on charitable contributions, including some from the Hill family. In those years, Mr. Hill's technology company did work for the nonprofit at no charge. Without that help, he said, NKR would have failed. By 2012, the charity had found its footing, pulling in nearly $1.5 million in revenue from hospitals. That year, NKR paid Hill & Company about $900,000 for database management and technology, as well as rent for shared office space in Babylon, New York. As it grew, NKR charged hospitals more. Annual NKR subscription fees for some hospitals have risen from roughly $2,500 in 2011 to about $30,000 today, according to contracts and bids reviews by the Times. The contracts also outline other possible fees, including for testing, travel, and logistics, that can exceed $60,000 per transplant. Just having patients in NKR is expensive, said Dr. Edward Hollinger, a transplant surgeon at Rush University in Chicago, which has worked with NKR. That's probably the biggest reason why programs don't do it. Mr. Hill said that NKR's fees have evolved consistent with the more sophisticated nature of our technology today. More than 100 hospitals work with NKR, he said, because they value these services. The organization also reimburses some donor costs, he added, including $6 million this year for lost wages. Hospital employees and consultants said transplant centers often request reimbursement for NKR fees from Medicare, the federal insurance program. Mr. Hill said that the many transplants enabled by NKR have saved the government money because those patients no longer need kidney dialysis. In an interview at the company's headquarters in Greenwich, Connecticut, Mr. Hill outlined the value of NKR's proprietary technology, which matches donors with recipients and manages complex travel logistics to quickly move organs around the country. The matching program is overseen by a medical board that includes donors, recipients, and transplant experts, many of whom work at subscribing hospitals. Mr. Hill said that NKR had enabled far more transplants than its competitors. They include a tiny government program that doctors said had been held back by red tape. NKR also makes better matches, Mr. Hill said, which helps transplanted organs last longer. Since NKR's first transplant in 2008, Mr. Hill said, living donation has grown at subscribing hospitals while falling at others. He said that was because his organization offered services, such as personalized websites, that attracted people who otherwise would never have donated. Some doctors were skeptical of NKR taking credit for those increases, given that the organization works with some programs that were already thriving or that had hired surgeons known for doing living donations. In any case, NKR has managed to create a large exchange used by people around the country, a feat that no public or private group had done before. I really have been just amazed and so impressed with what NKR was able to do, said Summer Gentry, a mathematician at New York University's medical school who has done research with NKR. They beat everybody. But along with that success, some experts said, come unchecked influence over a precious resource. It needs guardrails, said Karen Layden, a health policy expert at Tufts University, who has led the ethics committee of the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, which oversees the national transplantation system. NKR has grown with both carrots and sticks, financially incentivizing hospitals to add more donors and penalizing them if they tried to back out of agreements. One of those incentives? Waiving subscription fees for some hospitals that sign, quote, all-in contracts. In exchange, hospitals must add all of their incompatible pairs and altruistic donors to the registry. NKR also gives certain hospitals end-chain kidneys, the extra organs that result when a donor does not match anyone in the registry. Each year, according to NKR, it distributes about 500 such kidneys, leaving the hospitals to determine their recipients. That perk comes with strings attached, according to lawsuits filed by the University of Colorado Hospital Authority and Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. The hospitals tried to change their all-in agreements, but the contract stipulated that because the hospitals had accepted more kidneys from NKR than they contributed, they owed $1,000 a month for each outstanding kidney in perpetuity. The hospitals challenged these provisions in court, arguing that they violated the law against profiting off organs. But Mr. Hill told the Times these measures were not meant to generate revenue. They are designed to protect patient access to transplants and the integrity of the NKR network, he said. Both lawsuits were settled with undisclosed terms, and the hospitals did not comment on them. They both still work with NKR. One of NKR's most innovative policies, many doctors said, is known as voucher donation. Donors can choose to give their kidneys immediately in exchange for organ vouchers their loved ones redeem later. This arrangement has helped NKR expand its pool. But vouchers add risk for donors giving on behalf of hard-to-match patients. They might go through surgery months or even years before their loved one gets a match. Matches are especially unlikely, doctors said, for very highly sensitized patients who carry antibodies likely to reject a transplant. Mr. Hill said NKR's software is better at finding matches for these rare patients than the algorithm governing the deceased donors list. This year, he said, NKR matched 35 such patients, and voucher donation, he said, removes the risk of a donor backing out after a match was discovered. But many doctors said that given NKR's relatively small size, these rare patients would do better served waiting for a match before their loved ones donate. We definitely recommend that they not go with a voucher, said Dr. Miklos Molnar, the medical director of the kidney transplantation program at the University of Utah. Dozens of highly sensitized patients who are also on kidney dialysis have waited a year or more after their loved ones donated, according to NKR quarterly reports. At least three waited more than 4 years and one for 7 years. And now, from one of my favorite books, New York Times bestseller, The Book of General Ignorance, Everything You Think You Know Is Wrong, by John Lloyd and John Mitchinson, where they ask a question and answer it. The question today is, who invented rubber boots? Was it the Amazonian Indians? Was it the Duke of Wellington? Was it Charles Goodyear or Charles McIntosh? The answer: Amazonian Indians have been making instant gumboots since time immemorial by standing knee-deep in liquid latex until it dries. The boots designed for and named after the Duke of Wellington in 1817 were made of leather. The first rubber boots didn't appear until 1851, the year before the Duke died. Rubber was a disastrous failure for clothing when first tried because it either melted all over you in hot weather or set as hard as granite in winter. The breakthrough came in 1839 when Charles Goodyear heated rubber mixed with sulfur and accidentally spilled some on the family stove. Goodyear's story is inspiring and tragic by turns. He struggled in desperate poverty all his life. Six of his 12 children died of malnutrition, but rubber was his obsession, and he never gave up trying to improve the qualities of what he called vegetable leather. The process he had inadvertently discovered solved the rubber problem by giving it stable consistency. In his excitement, Goodyear shared his samples with Thomas Hancock and Charles McIntosh, who became successful British rubber merchants. After analyzing them, they were able to reproduce the process and patented it in 1843, calling it vulcanization after the Roman god of fire. Goodyear sued unsuccessfully and not for the first time was forced to spend time in a debtor's prison, or his, quote, hotel, as he liked to call it. He died still deep in debt, although widely acclaimed for his vision and perseverance. He once wrote, "Life should not be estimated exclusively by the standard of dollars and cents. I am not disposed to complain that I have planted and others have gathered the fruits. A man has cause for regret only when he sows and no one reaps." 40 years after he died, his immortality was assured when the founders of the Goodyear Tire Rubber Company, now the world's largest, named their business in his honor. Their 2005 revenues were $19.7 billion. Before we wind up today, just a reminder that following Science Journal at 7 p.m. is the Telegram and Gazette. At 8 p.m., USA Today. At 9 p.m., the Boston Globe. At 10, the Backyard Bookshelf Archives. And also at 11, the Backyard Bookshelf Archive. A reminder, there's all kinds of ways to listen to Audio Journal broadcast. You can listen live by streaming live from our website at audiojournal.org or through Zeno Media on your phone through by calling 712-770-1043. You can also listen with cable TV. A local cable TV station by checking our list to find your town by checking out audiojournal.org/listening with cable TV. Have you gotten your special receiver yet? You can tune right to Audio Journal's frequency, supplied at no cost. You need one? Give us a call at 508-797-1117. You can also listen through your smart speaker by saying, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn, or, hey, Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or on your smartphone, find Audio Journal on the Zeno Radio app at apps.apple.com, U.S. app, Zener Radio. Oh, no, you missed your favorite program? Don't worry about it. Look for podcasts on our website at audiojournal.org/locally produced programs. You have been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at, again, the phone number of 508-797-1117, or email us at info@audiojournal.org. I'm Tricia Droney. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
When Louise joined the German police department, she had an uncanny ability to sniff out the most concealed crimes. However, she was often confronted with resistance in the town. When children saw Louise, they would taunt her, screaming, "Pig! Pig! Pig!" But Louise bore it with silent dignity. In spite of continuous ridicule, she rose above the taunts and went about her business. How could she manage to remain so cool and indifferent?
And And here's the solution to our mystery.
Louise didn't mind being called a pig because she was one. Louise was a 230-pound boar, an animal known for its ability to sniff to a depth of 4.5 feet underground. Not only could she find clues to a crime, she could locate truffles, too.
And now back to our regular programming.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.